Hello, Catskills. Welcome to the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour.
I'm Julia Reichel.
I'm Lissa Harris.
The Watershed Post is a news hub, a bracing antidote to the idea that nothing ever happens in the Catskills.
And here's what we've got for you today.
Our guest is Pamela West Finkel. She is a South Courtright musician and teacher who has founded the Community Music and Arts Network. It's a new venture that aims to bring music and music making to people of all ages throughout the Catskills region.
But first, let's have a look at this week's headlines.
So there are a bunch of big stories this week because all the reporters took Thanksgiving off and ate turkey.
Most
and
of the newsmakers, too.
No, the newsmakers were all plotting things, as you can see, right?
Plotting and scheming.
Maybe they said, we just can't announce this until we have our turkey, but there's a bunch of big news this week, and a lot of it was announced in the past 2 days. The big story, one of several, is that Amphenol, which is a high-tech manufacturer in Sydney, is not going to be leaving Delaware County, despite possible rumblings that it would after its Sydney plant was damaged during Tropical Storm Lee in the beginning of September. The governor issued a press release Tuesday afternoon, reporting that a $20 million package of state funds helped convince Amphenol to stay in Delaware County and keep its 1,200 local jobs. That's more jobs than any one company in the whole county has.
There actually might be a few more jobs than that now. We hear from local radio reporter Rob Ray that the company has been calling back employees that were laid off over the last several years to pick up their jobs again. So this is good news for a lot of people in the Sydney area, and it's good news for Delaware County. And that's a giant chunk of money that they had to invest to get them to stay. But on the other hand, that facility has been hit very hard twice in a row by floods. It wasn't just this year's floods, but also a couple of years ago that they really got slammed by floods.
Yeah.
And kind of can't blame them for thinking about pulling up stakes. So they are gonna move to a new spot, though.
Well, the $20 million is going to the Delaware County Industrial Development Agency, which is going to help Amphenol build a new factory up the street from its current Delaware Avenue location in Sydney. Apparently, the new location is, quote, high and dry, unquote, according to the press release that was issued yesterday. But that's not where all the money's going. Some more of the money will build a levee around the current location, which will remain in use for the plating operations for the company, the plating many different items. it's sort of mysterious. Amphenol makes a lot of stuff.
We should probably get off of the topic of what exactly they make at Amphenol before we start.
I looked it up. There's many, many different things.
Yes.
And a lot of very expensive and difficult to make. High-tech products. So
it's great that they're staying, and a lot of folks in Sydney pleased about that.
Well, I have one other question for you, because you ran this story yesterday and you asked a tough question. You asked whether or not the Leatherstocking pipeline that was recently approved in Sydney had anything to do with this decision.
Well, yes. And actually, the people who have been in favor of the Leatherstocking pipeline,
gas pipeline
all along,
excuse me.
It's a gas and natural gas pipeline that's going to run through the town of Sydney. And that required an action by the town board of Sydney to approve it. And the people who are pro-pipeline have been saying all along that this is really necessary in order to keep Amphenol in town. And I spoke to Glenn Nealis, who is the director of economic development for Delaware County, about the Amphenol news, and said, is it really important? And he said, absolutely, yes, it is.
The pipeline
was critical in convincing Amphenol to stay.
There was a series of raucous public meetings in Sydney where a lot of anti-pipeline activists really were quite furious about Sydney's determination to pass the pipeline and allow it
to be
built.
It got kind of mixed up in Sydney town politics, which have been, shall we say, interesting over the last few years. And that meeting was very contentious.
It was an October meeting where
it was
approved.
You can see it. You can look it up on our website. There's a video, and it's one of those meetings where,
you go, oh my gosh.
Okay, I can't believe this was actually happening.
Yeah, it was just everybody was
people
was
screaming
upset.
And yeah, very, very upset. But they did pass the resolution to allow the pipeline to go through. And it seems to be, it seems to have worked out well for Amphenol, but there's still a lot of bad feeling in Sydney about that decision and about the people who made it. So
yeah, but 1,200 jobs is a lot of jobs, especially for Delaware County.
I should say also about the pipeline that people, the opponents of the pipeline saw it as a backdoor way to build some infrastructure that would encourage fracking. So it got mixed up in that issue.
Which
as
the Leatherstocking pipeline executives have stalwartly maintained denied. It has nothing to do with fracking. We will see. We will continue to follow the story. It's a big one and it's important.
Yes, indeed.
Another big story.
Moving right along from natural gas and aerospace parts to old people. Yay. while I'm being facetious, let me actually say a headline here. Protesters visited a meeting, or rather made their opinions known at a meeting held by the Ulster County Legislature.
Last night. In Kingston.
The topic was whether or not to privatize Ulster County's Golden Hill nursing home.
If you drive along Route 28 at all, you'll see signs about this issue that have been on people's lawns for years.
This is a very hot topic. The county executive, Mike Hine, has a plan for privatizing the Golden Hill nursing home, which has been a drain on county coffers for some time now. And they held it, so they held a hearing about it last night. And the interesting piece of this was that the anti-privatization protesters that came to the hearing actually were using some tactics of the Occupy Wall Street movement.
I want to play a clip for you from that meeting that our correspondent Ann Pyburn Craig took last night. Here we go.
It's a corporation.
It's a corporation.
What does the New York State Comptroller?
What does the New York State Comptroller?
Thomas DiNapoli.
Say.
About local development corporations.
So that was Ralph Childers, who's a member of Occupy Saugerties, talking against the idea of privatization. And those are some 50 or 60 people in the crowd echoing what he's saying.
You might recognize this particular tactic. It's been popularized recently by
Occupy Wall Street
and the many other Occupy movements around the country.
Occupy, fill in the blank.
It's called the human microphone.
And this is a tactic that they use in order to get speeches out amongst their members when they have no means of amplifying the human voice, like a microphone or broadcasters, something like that.
And that was the rule at Zuccotti Park in the Occupy Wall Street, sort of ground zero itself. But that wasn't the case last night.
Well,
right?
No, they had a microphone. So the reason they were doing it seemed to be more to allow everybody to have their voice heard, because only about 15 people signed up to speak. But the effect was of this, you know, this massive Borg saying no privatization. So
and you know, some and not everybody who did the Borg talking was necessarily part of the Occupy group, right?
No, you know, I wasn't there myself, but it seemed like they got some support from some folks that are not part of the Occupy movement that were also there to protest the privatization or
so
to
with
speak
the same
against
aim.
I shouldn't say protest, I should say, because they went there to you know, to let their feelings be known on the matter. So yeah, that was interesting.
Well, the fact that the human microphone is migrating to non-specifically Occupy movement sort of issues.
Well, and being used for a different purpose.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. And
not just to communicate, but to show crowd displeasure with something.
And you know, I'm thinking now, if that Sydney Leatherstocking Pipeline meeting had used the human mic, which
it would have been an entirely different meeting. That meeting was full of chaotic yelling and screaming.
And this would have been more orchestrated, loud talking.
Yeah.
Maybe so. That would have been an improvement. I don't know.
I don't know, but it does seem that the Occupy protesters have a variety of tricks in their tool bag, and they are, you know, they're deploying them. We're seeing them more and more in other kinds of protest situations.
And in Catskills area towns, which
is
neat. It's spreading. The legislature will vote on December 5th on whether or not to privatize the Golden Hill nursing home.
Well, the first step. It's the first
step.
Which would be transferring Golden Hill to an LDC.
My goodness.
Yeah, anyway.
Nothing is simple. It's true. Another big story this week. Again, a huge post-Thanksgiving announcement. Governor Cuomo actually had a big powwow with his upstate flooding response task force, which I wish they had little costumes. That would be so cute.
Oh, yeah. They should have hats.
Yeah, hats, some sort of cape.
It was kind of a closed doors powwow, wasn't it?
It was a closed... We sent another correspondent, and he emailed us and said, I can't get in to the powwow. It's closed.
So if you have a powwow, people, and someone shows up saying, I'm from the Watershed Post, you should let them in.
Well,
very
now,
important
we're being
people.
Unfair because he was trying to get into the powwow himself, not the press conference afterwards, which was open to the public. So it was at
anyway.
Windham Mountain, and afterwards, Governor Cuomo announced many different sort of flood remediation advancements in his administration's policy, including
key among them,
notably, yes,
some money.
Yes, three Catskills counties are going to get some wads of cash that are grants. They're not loans. You know, you don't have to pay them back. Each of them is $500,000.
Loan has become sort of a dirty word post-flood.
Yeah, well, you know, people who have a destroyed building, I mean, the idea of paying it back, even at very low interest, is sort of terrifying. I mean, if you have nothing.
But so, okay, so three counties are getting money. How much money is there?
Delaware County is getting $500,000. Greene County is getting $500,000. And Schoharie County is getting $500,000. And these funds are earmarked for specific flood-damaged towns. In Delaware County, it's Margaretville, Fleischmann's, and Sidney. In Greene County, it's four towns, Prattsville, Hunter, Windham, and Catskill. And it's Schoharie County, it's Middleburg and Schoharie. I was talking this morning with Jen Schumann on the morning show about how $500,000 for four towns in Greene County actually really isn't going to cover
not that much.
You know, restoring a bunch of Main Street buildings. It might, and I pointed out that in Margaretville, the Main Street block that was destroyed in flooding, the price tag on fixing that guy is kind of close to $500,000, depending on whose estimate you use. So
I don't have those numbers off the top of my head, but yeah, there's a lot more damage than in any one of these towns than $500,000 will fix. And yet, it's good news.
It's great news. I mean, the fact that the governor has taken the time to make a big stink about what upstate communities need post-flood is a good thing. There were a couple of other developments at the meeting. The governor is asking FEMA to cover 95% of New York's tropical storm recovery costs instead of the normal 75%.
Cross your fingers.
Again, we'll see whether FEMA says yes or no. And the governor is also trying to warn insurance companies that they need to respond to flood insurance claims about the flood promptly.
That has been an issue we've heard from many people, that they are having trouble getting prompt responses from their insurance companies.
You are listening to the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour. We're running through the week's headlines this week, and there are a ton of them because, as we've mentioned, everybody took Thanksgiving off. We have a couple more quick ones to throw at you before we have our guests.
A little bit of good news in Margaretville. The Flower Patch has finally opened up again, and so has the Bun and Cone. So that is, it's just thrilling to see these restaurants, which are kind of the heart of the community, coming back after being out of commission for so long because of flood damage.
Another, it's not directly flood related, but an interesting story in Prattsville. Just this morning, a big political surprise was announced, right, Lisa?
Oh, poor Prattsville. You know, I was just gearing up to have some kind of good news in Prattsville. The DEP just recently announced that they are opening up some more recreational lands in Prattsville and doing some cleanup. And the Prattsville also has a new website, which is really, really nice.
Prattsville.org.
Prattsville.org.
It's gorgeous.
But you know, so, and there's some bad news coming out of Prattsville, which is that their supervisor-elect, Alan Huggins, who was a write-in candidate and amazingly enough beat a sitting incumbent, Corey O'Hara, in the polls by a very narrow margin, he announced yesterday that he is stepping down.
He hasn't even taken office yet,
and he's already stepping down. And moreover, according to the Daily Mail, which reported this story today, there has been some scuttlebutt around town that this was in the cards, that it might happen, that he would step down and that one of his write-in backers would be named to replace him. That was not attributed to any source. It was just a little line in the story, so I don't know where that's coming from. But that's not good.
From a perspective of how democracy should work, having an elected official sort of throw his position to somebody is a weird thing to see.
I don't want to assume that it's true and that he was planning to step down all
could
the time.
Could be health reasons, right? He has had
documented health issues. But you know, he knew about those health issues long before he ran. It's a weird story. Prattsville is in a really tough place already. Its downtown was basically destroyed in the floods, and they have been really struggling to get back on track and to rebuild, and this doesn't help. What's going to happen is that someone is going to have to be appointed by the town board to fill the role of town supervisor for the first year of the term, and then there will be another election in November of 2012.
So those are all the headlines we have time for today. This is the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour. You are listening to us on WIOX 91.3 FM and WGXE 90.7 FM. Our guest today is Pamela West Finkel, the director of the Community Music and Art Network, a new venture that's bringing music and music making to all ages across the Catskills. And Pam also should be familiar to WIOX listeners because she hosts a Tuesday morning radio show on this very station. So radio is old hat for Pam. She also, if she doesn't have enough hats that she's wearing already, good God, that was a weird connection. Hats
and
hats.
Let's have more hat metaphors.
Too many hat metaphors. Pam is also one half of the acoustic folk rock duo Diviner, which is playing this Friday at Crossroads in Delhi from 7 to 9 p.m. Pam, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
You really are a triple threat. You have way too many things going on. You're just making me tired.
It's the story of my life. It just, you know, keeps me busy. I don't watch TV very much, so.
Yeah, I know how that is. Although I do watch more TV than I would care to admit, but it's all, you know, really highbrow science fiction, I swear.
We just have, like, Disney movies in our house because we have too many kids. So.
Right. Well, tell me about the Community Music and Arts Network. This is a relatively new venture. I know you've had some great press on it. I know the Mountain Eagle did a story on you and the Daily Star did, and it's a couple of months old, right?
Well, actually, technically, it is almost 10 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
The concept came about right after 9/11. I had been a Midwestern musician. I was classically trained. Then I went into rock and roll, and you know, got an opportunity to come to New York City. Actually, ironically, at the invitation of Keith Christopher, who's the guitarist from Esquelia. He was the bass player for Kenny Wayne Shepherd's band at the time.
So you had Catskills karma before you were in the Catskills.
Yeah. So somehow I ended up, you know, in New York City. And, you know, was doing well, and then 9/11 happened, and, you know, the music industry ground to a halt, and I had a teaching degree, and I answered an ad to teach music together, which is the early childhood curriculum that I use now. So I've been teaching that program for about 10 years. I made the decision to move out of New York City and the Jersey Shore in 2004. I'm from the country in Ohio, so I needed to be back in a country setting, you know, and I love the area up here. So I moved up here, and I started a center just after I had my baby. I met my husband like 6 weeks after I moved up here, and it was whirlwind. We got together. We were performing together.
Yes, your husband is the other half of Diviner.
Yep,
right?
And, you know, we got married like, 9 months after we met or something.
Nice. And, don't waste time. Why?
Yep. And so I started a center back in 2005 when we were over at the Evergreen and Fleischmann's, and it ended up that I needed some part-time income, so I applied for a job at Stanford Central School, and they hired me as their full-time music teacher, which is not the job I applied for, but it worked out, and I worked there for 5 years, and had a great opportunity because the original superintendent who hired me, I told him about my, you know, Community Music and Arts Network and what I wanted to do. So the school actually became a fiscal sponsor for an O'Connor grant. So really programs began officially, I would say, in 2007, 2008.
Oh, and with the help of Stanford Central School and
right,
the O'Connor
and
Foundation.
The O'Connor Foundation, and then the Roxbury Arts Group stepped in and gave us some additional grant monies. And, you know, we held a couple years of jam camps, and then I did some after-school programming, you know, trying different things for a couple of years. And then, of course, things changed over at Stanford, and then the money of the grant ran out, and we had to shut down the programs for about a year or so.
Mm.
And then when I found myself no longer employed by the public schools, I said, well, I might as well go back to doing this. I've got all 10 years of research and development and, you know, programming, and I made the decision to go ahead and, you know, give it a try and see. And, you know, I should have probably, I don't know, I don't want to say I should have opened it in Oneonta because Part of my mission statement is really the community music purpose, and that is to provide all access, all ages, to anyone. You know, these types of programs very often are only found in, cities mm-hmm. and larger metropolitan areas where you've got more culture and that type of thing. But community music is really a movement that is bringing music and music programs to small rural communities.
It's an international movement in origin, right? It comes from Australia and Britain?
Britain, yeah. It started actually in officially as a movement. It started in the 1960s in Great Britain. And I think part of that was due to the work of a sociologist named Christopher Small, and also the work of the Nordoff Robbins Foundation and Dr. Clive Robbins, who was based in England at the time. He's now at NYU, working with the Nordoff Robbins down there. But in Australia, in Ireland, in places where there's a lot of, small towns that are far dispersed, these types of centers where people of all ages can come together and, improvise together, jam together, write music together. The early childhood is non-formal instruction, and we get together and we do what people did 100 years ago, just as part of being part of their families and communities. But
you pick up a gourd, you rattle it,
yeah,
you pick up a tambourine, you shake it.
Africans will get together and play all night, just to have fun. There's a great, Bela Fleck did a great documentary called Throw Down Your Heart, and that was very inspirational. I was also really inspired by, when I was in New York City, there was a man named Bill Bennett who created an organization called Off the Wall Street Jam. And that was more geared towards adults, but, high school students and kids could join as well. And he had different age levels and different groups, and he basically facilitated rehearsal space and sign-ups for people that had regular day jobs to be able to come and just have fun and improvise, because anybody who's in a band and tries the music industry thing really understands that there's a lot of time that goes into, promotions and booking and, all the administrative work that goes with it, plus all the lugging of the equipment and the
never-ending.
So, for people, amateurs, I guess you could say, to be able to get together and do it in a non-formal type instructional environment. One of the things I find is that people, that go to a private lesson, per se, they're learning the skills, they're learning the rudiments, and all those things are exceptionally important, but they don't have a practical application to apply those skills. So very often, parents will invest in an instrument, they'll invest in the lessons.
Right, and the trombone goes into the
closet,
gets dusty.
When you learn a repertoire, right, you don't get to jam, you don't get to improvise.
Right, and it's funny because a lot of guitarists are now being taught via tablature. And really, tablature is just another way of, classically training someone. So, we do a lot of work because, as a public school teacher, I knew that, I only have 30, 40 minutes with these kids. Classroom management and state standards and all those things come into play. And so very often you don't have time to get to the higher levels of music making, which is improvisation and composition and, songwriting and all these types of things.
Pamela Westfinkel, we're talking with Pam about her Community Music and Arts Network. You have a physical location, right? There's sort of a place where people can come to do this gathering. Tell us about it.
It is currently located at the Hobart Activity Center, not the Community Center. It's the Activity Center, which is the old school. And that is my general center of operations. So we teach about half the early childhood music classes, plus then all of the after-school programming there. And it's a nice centralized location because it's about a half an hour from everything.
Hobart, we're half an hour from everything.
Yep. And originally I thought of the after-school program as being something that was going to serve kids from Stanford School District, South Courtright, mostly because they're right there within 5-10 minutes drive. What I'm finding is the majority of the kids that are signing up for the program are coming from a half an hour to 40 minutes away. I've got kids coming from Windham, Otsego, Oneonta, Delhi, Andes, So I'm personally kind of expanding my advertising for that program now because I think that, there is a need for it, and people are willing to drive their kids there. And so, and it's a flexible drop-off. We run it from 3 to 5. Tuesdays are the high school kids, Thursdays are K through fourth graders, and Fridays are fifth through eighth graders. And, you know, drop-off is any time between 3 and 4, and pick-up's at 5 o'clock. And we pretty much just see who's there that day and get a direction and get a focus. And the kids rotate on the instruments. They get to play a little bit of drums, a little bit of bass, guitar. They get to sing. We do some songwriting.
I got to say, Pamela, as a parent of a three-year-old, this sounds like a lot of work for me, having to drive half an hour each way. Why can't I just put my kid in front of Baby Einstein?
Oh, because recent research, if you notice, they've taken a lot of those products off the market. And they've actually found that by just sitting your child in front of the television, and actually a recent study just came out a month ago, saying that kids under the age of 2 shouldn't even be watching TV, not only just, you know, watching these videos, but they really should not even be watching, period.
Even if it's beautiful Mozart cantatas.
Because what it's doing is it's rewiring their brains to passively receive music. We survived as a human species because of our music-making abilities. We were able, you know, back 20, 50,000 years ago, to come together in large groups of 500 or 1,000 or thousands of people to ward off, you know, predators and that type of thing. Because of our music-making ability, and we are really wired to be active music makers. If a child starts an early childhood music program before the age of, say, 6, within 3 years, 80% of those children become what we call musically competent, which means they can sing in tune. They can keep a beat. And as many adults know who think that they're tone deaf with two left feet, you know, that's a skill that they think is a talent, but it's really something that is a language thing that we are wired to have. But if you do not incorporate the early childhood, then after the age of 9, any basic skills that you were born with begin to atrophy, just like a muscle that does not get used.
Pamela, I have to stop you because
that's
have...
I know, I told you I was a talker.
No, that's why I asked you on the show. I thought you would be a great talker, and you indeed are. We're talking with Pamela West Finkel, who is the founder of the Community Art Music and Arts Network in Hobart, and she has a whole bunch of events coming up this week, which we actually catalog on our This Weekend column and in our community calendar at watershedpost.com/calendar. So thank you so much, Pam, for joining us. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour from WIOX 91.3 FM. Events are back with a vengeance now that everybody's eaten their turkey and is ready to party. This Friday is Phoenicia First Friday. That's First and Friday with a PH. With C.B. Smith and Mark Sloan at the Arts Upstairs Gallery at 8 p.m. 60 Main Street, Phoenicia. It's an open mic at 10 p.m. And there is a requested donation of $3 to benefit the Phoenicia Cat Project.
On December 3rd, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., is the Woodstock Elementary Holiday Gift Fair. Buy from local artists and vendors and do your holiday shopping to support the Woodstock Elementary PTA.
Yeah, it's Christmas season. The O'Connor Hospital is also having a big holiday parade and open house on December 3rd from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday at the hospital in Delhi.
If you were listening a couple of weeks ago to our radio show, you probably heard Jess Vecchione, a local filmmaker, talking about her new film, Robert. That is screening on December 3rd at 2 p.m. in the Skeen Library in Fleischmann's.
That's this Saturday at 2 p.m. Also on Saturday, a lot of stuff. There's the Andes tree lighting at 3 p.m. in Bowman Park, which is right next to the library on Main Street. Santa apparently will be arriving on a fire truck, so you've been warned.
Acoustic folk rock duo Diviner, which includes Pamela West Finkel, who we've just been speaking to. The other half of Diviner would be her husband, Theodore Finkel. They are performing at the Crossroads Cafe on December 2nd at 7 o'clock p.m. That's Friday, right, Julia?
Friday night, 7 p.m.
Friday night, 7 p.m. Be there.
On Saturday, also in the Village of Hunter, the National Marionette Theater is producing Pinocchio. And it's going to be awesome. Big puppets. I mean, you can't go wrong.
That should be fun. Mike and Ruthie are going to be at the Empire State Railroad Railway Museum, courtesy of Flying Cat Music, on Sunday, December 4th at 7:30 p.m. And if you haven't seen Mike and Ruthie, you should get to this one as well.
You're such a groupie.
They're fantastic.
Come on now, listen.
Oh, they're really, really good. They're local folksters.
These events and more are featured in our This Weekend column at watershedpost.com/thisweekend. And that wraps up this week's edition of the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour.
The Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour originates from the studios of WIOX 91.3 FM in Roxbury. Our technical guru is Mike Teitelbaum. Our theme music is by Fred Harris of Elephant Company in Delhi. The cheesy banter is all ours.
The mispronunciations also all ours.
The mispronunciations are usually mine. Please join us every Wednesday at 1 p.m. right here at WIOX 91.3 FM and at 3 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM.
WatershedPost.com, the source for news and information in the Catskills.